Welcome to the Studying the Bible podcast, where every Thursday, Pastors Dylan Dodson and Brian Androsian study a book of the Bible, verse by verse, to see what is being communicated and how we can use it to grow in our relationship with Jesus. We pray that today's podcast can help you grow just a little bit closer to Christ.
Welcome back to our online Bible study through the book of Esther. In this session number 6, we're going to be in Esther chapter 6. Now, where we left off is that Haman is furious with Mordecai. Even though he's been invited to a second banquet with the king and with Esther, where she is going to make her request known to the king, he decided, by the advice of his wife, to create a gallows to hang Mordecai on, to have him killed on the spot. And so in the morning, which is what we're going to see happening here, the next day he's going to go before the king, make sure this king signs off on it, and then hang and kill Mordecai. But something else happens in the middle of the night. And here's Esther chapter 6, verse 1. That night, sleep escaped the king. So he ordered the book recording daily events to be brought and read to the king. So the chronicles, the annals, what this is referring to, these were records that were kept of the happenings in the kingdom, the major events. And so for whatever reason, again, we're not told why, although we can imagine, we can see the providence of God working. The king can't sleep, and so he wants to read, for whatever reason, things that have happened in the kingdom in the past and what is going on. Verse 2. They found the written report, as he's reading these, of how Mordecai had informed on Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the entrance, when they planned to assassinate King Ahasuerus. The king inquired, what honor and special recognition have been given to Mordecai for this act? The king's personal attendants replied, nothing has been done for him. Right? And so the king happens to come across, again, happenstance here, again, or maybe God's providence working. He reads the account of years ago, or previously, how we read about a couple chapters ago, where Mordecai saves the king's life, but yet he wasn't rewarded. In fact, what we read about in the story of Esther, the book of Esther, is that he doesn't get rewarded, but then whatever reason, we're not told why, Haman gets to move up in the ranks in the kingdom. And so, again, the king realizes, the Mordecai remembered, he was reading how he saved his life, and nothing was ever done about it. Again, this is about 5 years ago. And this is a big deal for the king, right? It's a big deal. It's important for the king to reward this type of behavior so that people keep doing it, right? So that people, when they find out that someone's trying to assassinate the king, that they would tell the king. This is not just the king being benevolent. This is the king really looking out for his own self-interest. You want to reward, and reward handsomely, people who keep you alive. And so he is probably quite worried and in shock and cannot believe that nothing, that he or whoever should have been in charge of rewarding Mordecai, that nothing was done, that this man literally saved his life. So here's the king's response, verse 4. The king asked, who is in the court? Now Haman was just entering the outer court of the palace to ask the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's attendants answered him, Haman is there, standing in the court. Have him enter, the king ordered. So again, Haman happens, again, another happenstance, happens to be in the court. He's likely there and early and excited about the day ahead and to get rid of Mordecai. I mean, there's a pep in his step. He cannot wait to see the king. And he gets to have this banquet with the king and the queen. He gets to hang Mordecai, his bitter enemy. I mean, this is probably the best of the best. It does not get, literally does not get better if you're Haman. So he's excited. The king wants to ask him a question. Verse 6. Haman entered, and the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king wants to honor? Haman thought to himself, who is it the king would want to honor more than me? So before the Haman can ask the king about hanging Mordecai, the king asks Haman how he should honor a man that he wants to honor. Now Haman, of course, in his pride and his arrogance, he's moved up in the kingdom, is assuming, well, of course he's asking about me. Who else would he be asking about? And of course, as the reader, we are dismayed that Haman is the one who will decide how Mordecai is honored, right? So Haman thinks it's about him, but at the same time, you're thinking, man, this guy, why is he going to be the one that gets to influence the king about what the king should do to honor Mordecai when he's the one who wants to, as we would say, unjustly kill Mordecai and wipe out all of his people? And so, of course, in his pride and arrogance, what does Haman do? Well, he's going to suggest the highest honors. Verse 7, Haman told the king, "For the man the king wants to honor, have them bring a royal garment that the king himself has worn and a horse the king himself has ridden, which has a royal crown on its head. Put the garment and the horse under the charge of one of the king's most noble officials. Have them clothe the man the king wants to honor, parade him on the horse through the city square, and proclaim before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king wants to honor.'" So he says, put on one of the king's robes, which would have been a massive honor. Ride a horse that the king has ridden, which was considered probably, if not the highest honor. And appear before the people. Now, this also is the belief. There's also this belief, again, he's the king, the gods had placed him there, that he is some sort of deity, that the king's robes the king's robes were thought of to even kind of maybe include some of this deity, this king's deity magic, and to just get some of the king's amazingness, if you will, rubbed off on you. I mean, it's kind of, maybe put in modern examples, not the best analogy, but maybe to think of how amazing this is. Imagine riding the Air Force One, right? The plane that the president of the United States goes around in, right? If you were going on Air Force One and people took pictures of you and it was on TikTok and Instagram and YouTube and all over the place, people would have assumed you matter, right? If this average person goes on Air Force One with the president, regardless of who the president is, when this would have taken place, that's not what's important. But the point is, imagine this was you, some average person people don't know about. They see online that this average person is going on Air Force One. They would just assume with the president that you mattered, that there was something significant about you, that you would get to ride on that. So that's what's happening here, but even trumped up even more. And of course, Haman doesn't realize what is about to happen. I mean, this is kind of the ultimate example of what we read about in the Proverbs, that pride comes before the fall. In his pride and his arrogance, he is about to come absolutely humiliated. And so here's what happens next, chapter 6, verse 10. "The king told Haman, 'Hurry and do just as you proposed. Take a garment and a horse for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not leave out anything you have suggested.' So Haman took the garment and the horse. He clothed Mordecai, and look at this, paraded him. Haman's the one that paraded him through the city square, crying out before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king wants to honor.'" I mean, look at this irony. This is the ultimate reversal and ultimate humiliation for Haman. Right? The king, again, he's unaware of the hostility between Haman and Mordecai. The king has no idea that Mordecai is the reason Haman wanted to come up with this plan to wipe out all the Jews. And however, what's interesting is that many in the king's court likely would have known. Right, they would have seen Haman coming and going. They probably would have heard the chatter. They obviously knew that the Jews were going to be extinct, or that was the plan. They would have known that Mordecai never bowed to Haman. They probably would have known the disdain that Haman had for Mordecai, but the king didn't. And then Haman not only isn't the one that gets to be honored, he has to lead Mordecai around the city square. And not only does he have to lead Mordecai, he has to be the one that cries out, "Look at this man, the one the king wants to honor." I mean, you have to think here of how humiliating this was for the king, for Haman, in ways that we probably fully can't understand. But again, you see the pride, man, how quickly his pride has led him to disgrace. Again, he thinks it's for him, finds out it's for his most bitter enemy, and he has to be the one that parades him around the city. And so here's his response, verse 12. Here's what happens next, rather. "Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried off for home, mournful and with his head covered," absolutely, publicly humiliated. He goes with his head covered. And then it says, verse 13, "Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, 'Since Mordecai is Jewish and you have begun to fall before him, you won't overcome him because your downfall is certain.'" So Haman goes home. explains, I mean, he's absolutely humiliated. He's grieving. He doesn't want to show his face anywhere. And he goes and tells his wife and his friends what happened. Now, and they're likely seeing now the God of the Jews is powerful and cannot be wiped out. Not that they necessarily believed in Yahweh, the God of the Jews, but people would assume that events that happened in your life were controlled by the gods you worshipped. So clearly, whoever this God is that this Jew worships, and they know he's Jewish because it mentions it here in the text, well, he's clearly out to get you, or he clearly cannot be mocked in the way that you are wanting to do it. And so the irony here is that it was their idea, remember, to hang Haman, or to hang Mordecai. It was not Haman's idea. It was his wife and his friend's idea. And now it's ironic because they're the ones that are now telling him, well, things are not going to go well for you because you constructed these gallows to kill him. And now he is being held in high esteem by the king. You think the king is now going to want to kill him, and you think you suggesting that's going to be a good idea. He got it. They got it. He got some advice in chapter 5. And now it's turned out to be absolutely terrible advice. And looks like it's going to continue his downfall. And then verse 14, last verse we'll read, it says this. While they were speaking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and rushed Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. So he hears all these bad news. He is devastated. They're all worried that Haman's or Mordecai's God seems to be up to something because this Jewishness, and you wanted to kill and wipe out all the Jews. Now this Jew is being honored in high prominence in front of all of the city. And of course, word would spread around the nation, around the kingdom about Mordecai. He's being held esteem. Things are not going well. Things are not certainly going at all how Haman would have hoped when he woke up this morning. And now he has to go to the banquet. And so as we read chapter 6, again, I want to leave you with a couple of things and one note that's worth sharing. The first is this. Pride, I believe, is the number one predictor of ongoing sin in your life. Now, of course, pride is what leads to the downfall of Haman here. But I think in our own lives, pride is often the reason we keep sinning. And I say that because it is our pride that keeps us from repentance. It is our pride that keeps us from telling other people when we are struggling because we are afraid of how they're going to think of us. It is our pride that also makes us think that we can overcome an issue or a struggle or a weakness on our own. So the pride can make us ashamed to tell other people so we don't. Our pride can also make us assume that we are strong enough on our own to overcome whatever is coming our way, even though our past history has shown us that we cannot. We need the help of God's Spirit and God's community, the local church in our life. And so I would encourage you to look at your life as I look at my life and to think about the ongoing sin weaknesses that you might be currently dealing with. And the question is, what are you doing about it? Or put another way, how is your pride stopping you from tackling it or from making advances on it or from trying to honor God better in that area? Is it because you think you can on your own, but you can't? Are you afraid of what anyone would think, so you do nothing with it? Are you too afraid to tell anybody because of what people might think of you? Right? How is pride encouraging ongoing sin in your life, and what can you do about it? It seems that pride is the number one predictor of ongoing sin in your life and in mine. Second thing that we clearly see happening here is that nothing happens outside of God's control. Let me point out something to you. This chapter, as we mentioned briefly, or somewhat, I'll mention in more detail here, is full of irony and supposed happenstance, right? Though as readers, as we see thing after thing after thing happen, we know it can't be luck. We know God is up to something. So, for example, here are some of the things we've read about so far in the book of Esther, right? Mordecai just happens to be the one to hear about the plot to kill the king, right? He happens to be the one to find out about it. And then he happened not to get rewarded when it originally happened, right? Because if he had been originally rewarded 5 years ago, the king would have forgot about it and nothing would have happened. And Haman's plan probably most likely could have continued to go forward. But because the king happened to not reward him then, something happens later. Right, the night that Mordecai was supposed to be hanged on the gallows, it says the king, you know, of course here, just happens to have a sleepless night right before Haman requests to kill him. And so the king asks for the records of the kingdom to be brought to him, and he just happens to read the account of Mordecai saving his life that night. Right, of all the things he could have read, he just happens to come across that. Of course, Haman just happens to be the one who comes into the king's court first, and so the king asks him about how to honor someone. It just happens to be Haman. And then, of course, Haman, because he's the one that suggested it, happens to be the one who has to parade Mordecai around the city. Or last thing, Mordecai, who is a Jew, just happens to be honored right before Esther is going to approach the king and intervene for the Jews, right? A Jew just happens to be honored right before another Jew, Esther, asks the king not to completely wipe out the Jewish people, right? After he finds out that it was a Jew who has saved him. Right? And so again, it's just important for us to remember that in a polytheistic worldview like this at the time, fate was meant to whichever God had the upper hand at that moment. And so what we see here, however, is that God was in control all along. Right? Again, it's why Haman's wife and his friends assume that things are not going to go well for Haman because, well, purely to them, the Mordecai's God just happens to have the upper hand at the moment, so things are not going to go well for you. Now, as readers, what we see happening here is, again, God has been in control all along, letting things happen in ways that we might not understand or might not like so that his glory can be revealed. Now, again, we're not Esther, we're not Mordecai. I've said that a lot through this study, but it's important to think about our own lives and the situations that we face. I love how Karen Jobes, in her commentary on this passage in the book of Esther, she puts it this way. She says, consider, as you think about your own life, consider how God has guided and directed your life. How did you come to meet and marry your spouse? Why are you living in the place you are? What circumstances led you to your current job? God's care and protection for his children seldom come by mighty miracles, but constantly and inexorably, with the unfolding circumstances of each day as one thing leads to another. Tiny miracles of God's providence direct your step. Tiny things here and there that we don't see. Now, it's easy for us to see here because it's in a short book that we can read fairly quickly, and so we can be reminded of all the ways that God has worked. It's so easy for us to forget throughout the longevity of our lives and the years and the seasons, the little things that God has done for us. Nothing happens outside of God's control. And then finally, last point I would say is this, that there are no accidents in God's providence. There's no accidents. Again, things happen that are evil, that are wrong, that we wish that they would not have happened. But for God, it's never an accident. It doesn't catch him by surprise. Now, of course, one day we know he will make all things right. And we are, it's very human, and I would say it's okay to question and have doubts and to wonder why God doesn't stop things or why God allows certain things to happen. Yet for God, who holds all things together, he is sometimes weaving a story that we cannot even think or imagine at the moment, and clearly that is happening here. Right? It kind of reminds us of the well-known verse in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, where Joseph's brothers, you know, sell him into slavery into Egypt because they were jealous of his favoritism from Jacob, his father, and then there's a massive famine, and all these people are coming, and, you know, Joseph had prepared the famine in Egypt, and so they had stored enough grain, and so people from surrounding nations are coming from Egypt during the seven-year famine to try to get something so they can survive. His brothers happen to come, and they realize it's Joseph. Joseph realizes it's them, and you think Joseph is going to strike them down for what he's done, but what does it say? Genesis 50, verse 20, Joseph says, "You planned evil against me. God planned it for good to bring about the present result, the survival of many people." Right? Many people, thousands, tens of thousands of people, survived because Joseph had come up with this plan to store grain, knowing that a famine was coming. And so the evil that his brothers originally planned to get rid of him, to sell him into slavery, has actually turned out to be a good thing. Now, of course, Joseph doesn't want to be sold into slavery. If you read the life of Joseph in Genesis, a lot of bad things happened that he didn't enjoy, but yet God still used it. That there are no accidents in God's providence. And so my encouragement to you is that you might be in a really difficult time, a really hard time, and it's not to say that everything is going to work out the way you want. But I would say this, that you have no idea. You have no idea how God might be using your experiences, your pain, your depression, your addiction, your struggles for the good of others and his glory. That if you remain faithful, that you be honest with others, that you don't let your pride keep you from getting the help that you need, the love that you need from other people and other followers of Jesus, that you have no idea how your story might impact other people in the future. That God, how God might use you, what you've experienced and what you've done to bring other people to Him. So remain faithful, keep going, and know that there are no accidents in God's providence.